The masters almost surely have a plan. There's clearly maybe something there beyond the realm of man. And until you've thoroughly tested every last close trusted view, I find the more you think you know, the less you really do.
That's true, Dr. Zaius.
Very well.
Where would we be without THC? Cause we know they're lying to us, just don't know.
Hallelujah, Higher Side Chatters from sunny San Diego. I, of course, am Greg Carlwood, and today is a great show with returning guest Sylvie Ivanova from the New Earth YouTube channel. I love talking to her about the past and various megaliths because not only does she have an interesting position, but she also pays a lot of attention to sites and ruins that largely go unnoticed when it comes to the big names in the field that we typically see. I definitely learned new stuff in this one, and that's a beautiful thing. Of course, English is not her first language, so when the interview was done, she emailed me and said she had some additional thoughts to the questions I asked her, and she sent me a handful of additional audio clips. And it's great that she cares so much and is willing to put even more into the process when sometimes just getting people to show up can be difficult. But the reason I preface the show with this is because sometimes when you record audio in a different environment, it just sounds different. And so there's not a lot I can do about that. It has to do with the room, how far you are away from the mic, your tone, recording locally versus recording over Skype, and there's just no way to make it seamless. So when it applied, I added her new audio to the end of her answers, and it sounds a little jarring at times, but you end up with about an extra half hour of show, so I think it's a win. It's not the kind of thing you can just throw in there without telling people either, because it is odd, so just a heads up. But I was happy to get into a topic that's deep and rich and has nothing to do with politics or the election cycle drama. I just think sometimes we need to unplug from that. So brace yourself and let's do the damn thing. Megaliths, Lost Civilizations, and the Chronological Cover-Up with Sylvie Ivanova.
Drink a little drink, my friend. Smirk a little smirk. Cause it looks like this.
All right, Higher Side Chatters, we know the parasites of the Vatican and the Holy Roman Empire are responsible for quite a few crimes against humanity, but one of the most interesting manipulations that has been suggested is the vast alteration of the human timeline. It seems a very good case can be made that during the Reformation period of the 1500s, a campaign was launched to install new royals across Europe and restructure history to justify their rule and obscure a past that wasn't under their control. As far-fetched as it might sound, the facts remain that most of our chronology was written by a handful of Jesuit monks, and in the introductions of their own work, they fully admit to translating, recording, and correcting the documents they synthesized before the convenient destruction of the source material. So do we just blindly trust the deceptive authorities, or do we work to undo the damage and re-examine the human story with what little we have left? Well, that has been the noble goal of today's returning guest, Sylvie Ivanova, who has been examining the world's megaliths and ancient ruins to try to reconstruct a picture of the past that gets closer to the truth and allows us to rely on what we can see with our own eyes rather than what's written in the corrupted history books. And she lays this all out on her New Earth YouTube channel and her website, megaliths.org. She's one of my favorite people on the planet. Sylvie, welcome back.
Hello, Greg. Thanks for inviting me again.
Of course. It's great to talk to you. I'm always impressed by the videos you put out. I also really need to thank you again for the hours and hours you put into helping facilitate and translate our interview with Alexander Kultepin. To translate 4 pages of questions into Russian, conduct the 2-hour interview, then listen back to it and re-record his responses in English for me. I mean, that was a lot of work and so many listeners appreciated it. But we didn't really get to hear your thoughts on it. Did you get any new insights from Alexander during that process?
No, because I made an interview with him before that, and I asked him very similar questions.
Fair. Well, thanks again. I do know it was time consuming, and the people really liked being able to reach past the language barrier like that. He has a lot of intriguing work, from the study of other humanoids like dwarves and elves to those ancient vehicle tracks he's found. It was a real pleasure just to be a part of that. And it's awesome to have you back. We decided to do this now because you just came back from doing some field research in Italy, which you're going to be making a documentary about soon. But tell us about that trip. Why Italy?
Why Italy? Because it is literally full of ruins.
Hmm.
They're in everybody's backyard. That is especially in the area north of Rome, where we spent 10 days. In certain areas, even most of the modern roads are built on the top of rock-cut roads left by this ancient civilization. Almost everybody who has a garden has this type of ruins in their home. Very few of them are labeled as historic sites because it's so many thousands of them. Just the sheer amount of ruins made me go there. And what I was asking myself is, why do they look the same as similar rock-cut ruins that are found in a belt stretching from China to Portugal in great concentration, and even possibly on other continents, South and North America, Indonesia, Japan, but those are more isolated cases. But this belt is just full of them. So that's what made me go there, and I don't regret for doing so.
Yeah, I saw the trailer that you laid out, and it looks like there's quite a few things, like ancient garages. There's also this area that looks like it's been bored out that you could almost park a train in. Pretty impressive.
Yeah, that's the association that everybody in the group could make when we saw them. They were just long and dark, and all of them with uniform cuttings on the floor, like the floor was recessed, and there were quite few of them. So since we saw so many garages already, this could not be an ordinary garage anymore, so this must have been for the trains.
And do we find those same type of tracks in Italy too?
Oh yes, Italy is full of tracks, definitely, and very unusual markings, tracks. And just a few days ago, I saw the photos from the newly discovered field in Turkey, and over there, I see the same strange tracks.
Hmm. So who do you think is responsible for these ruins or the structures that you found? Is there any way to say or get any kind of insight into who they might have been?
Yes, I can definitely say for sure that there was a single civilization. It has distinctly at least two layers, one of them much older, or two groups of layers, even maybe that much. But the older one definitely stretches at least from China to Portugal, and the somewhat younger looking one stretches all the way from like Jordan and the Middle East to Spain and Portugal. Who has built that? We don't even have a name for this civilization because nobody bothered to study it so far. The mainstream historians, it doesn't fit into the picture they have been preaching, so they are not interested. We saw how they even have destroyed ruins, valuable and very interesting ruins from this civilization, so they're not interested in it. Then ordinary people, they're just practically they're not noticing them. We had a local guide, Simon. He is a viewer of my channel, and he first got in touch with me when I announced the Italy expedition, and he lived right in the heart of this region. And in the first email he wrote me, "I think you will be disappointed. I think you're talking about these holes that we use to store our garden tools in." And after that, I mentioned to him a few interesting places, and when he went and visited, he was shocked himself what he discovered.
Yeah, it's impressive. There's also, I think, was it that video where you found tunnel systems that were too small and narrow to have been built by humans?
Now that's something else. That's this one at least has a name. It's called Erdstahl. That's the single Erdstelle plural in German. They have a German name because they are mostly in German-speaking regions like Germany, Switzerland, and Austria. Now, those are very similar to these ruins that I'm talking about, and they probably could be classified as one of the later layers of this enormous rock cutting that has been going on in antiquity. Which the most amazing of everything, according to everybody in the group, is the amount of ruins.
Hmm.
Many millions of people must have been in this civilization. It's not something small. Yeah, it's just everywhere. I mean, even as you drive on the sides of the road, everybody, everywhere, hewn stones, right angles, just everywhere.
Right, and that is one of the major points here. It's kind of what you're contending, is that these remnants of ancient civilization are all over Italy, in the cities, in the backyards, along the roads, and people don't even realize what they're seeing, but you recognize the same cuts and styles all over the place, and it's indicative of a lost, far-reaching culture, hidden in plain sight. And seeing the ruins, you do make a great case. And one example you show in the footage is a picture of what's described as a Roman-era gate, but it's clearly patched into a much older wall, and it makes for a good example of this obscurification of history, doesn't it?
Yeah, you're talking about the amphitheater in Sutri, right?
Yes.
Before visiting, I was always under the impression that the Roman-looking gate was added afterwards. I don't know why I thought like that. But when I was there, I was looking and carefully at it, and then I noticed actually this gate is kind of geopolymer with lines drawn on it. And then I asked the lady who was the tour guide over there, and she said, oh, no, this full gate was added by the restoration team. I was shocked. This is obvious forgery. They just put the full Roman thing to make it look Roman. And I was like, really? I was so surprised. I asked her openly, how could they do that to put such a Roman patch on this old amphitheater? And she was looking at me with questionable eyes. She says, what do you mean? But this is a Roman amphitheater. I said, what do you mean it's Roman amphitheater? You have thousands of, in this very archaeological park, you have thousands of what you call Etruscan necropolises. It's another question if they are such indeed, but you call them Etruscan necropolises. And this is clearly a part. It's in the same style. It's with same age. There is no doubt it's part of it. I mean, the necropolises were on its walls. So I asked her, how can you call this amphitheater Roman if it's obviously not Roman? Well, she said, you know what? They must have hired local workers and they made it in their own style. You mean the Romans?
Right. Yeah, it just seems like the story unravels when you start asking just a couple of questions.
But I heard something else, another piece of information, much more precious, from this very same lady, who was actually very sincere. She openly spoke with me without, because other tour guides, if you start asking too many questions, they feel personally offended, but this one was very sweet, actually. So she was sharing with us, and she mentioned that she works at this archaeological park since year 2001. And she remembers clearly that when she started working, the steps of the amphitheater were much sharper. So even within such a short span of time, they have eroded so much. And this confirms once again what I have been already suggesting in older videos, that erosion is much, much faster than usually people are led to believe by mainstream geology.
Right. And that gets into the point that I mean, of course, we've talked about the fact that you can't really trust the dating methods that the establishment relies on, but it seems like your opinion is that they're much younger in a lot of cases than we're told, as opposed to the alternative, which usually says that they're far, far older.
Yes. Now, another conclusion, very important one, that I made after this expedition, and that will sound absolutely revolutionary probably to many listeners, is about the age of these famous polygonal megaliths, because we saw them as well in Antica Norba and in Amelina. They have gigantic polygonal walls, quite huge blocks, almost human size, one of them. And, you know, it's very different when you visit and you see the ruins in their natural environment. So in this case, I must say that both mainstream historians and alternative ones, I think, are severely mistaken with their age. I didn't have any prejudice. How old are they? In the past, I always said, I really don't know. But now I do have an opinion. And I will tell you what it is based on. I saw really old stuff. I saw how it looks. It is buried with clay. It bears little connection with the current ground level. Huge blocks turned over, severe erosion. All these things that I just listed, they're not very well visible on the huge polygonal megaliths. They're very near to the current street level. They're relatively well preserved, while the older rocket stuff that lays next to them and is made of the very same stone under the same conditions is much, much more eroded. So I can tell you for sure that these things are not, what to speak of, 12,000 years old. Just by the looks, I would doubt that they are older than 1,000 years. This is from the looks only. Otherwise, taking into consideration other factors, I would say maximum couple of thousand years.
Wow. Yeah, you really bring that stuff forward. And I have heard you put it that anything older than 200 years in terms of our history is highly questionable. Anything older than 500 is probably pure fantasy. And that probably sounds pretty far out for some people. But could you paint us a picture of what you think might have been going on 600 or 700 years ago?
Well, maybe at that time they were building these megaliths. Also, once I saw this situation, overall situation with how young they look, then I also, other things started coming up in my mind. I also realized that the alternative researchers, they look at them taken out of context. They show you a really magnificent polygonal wall in Peru, and they tell you, you see, this could not have been built by the Incas with their primitive bronze tools. Actually, we don't have any reliable information about the Incas. We are told that it was based on the first documents of the colonizers. Those documents were never published. They are locked until now. They were not published when they were written. Why they were hiding them? People must have been interested at that time. America was discovered. Why they were hiding them from the very beginning? None of them are available in original, and some of them are not even available in edited form. So it's absolutely unfair to base their dating, to say they're older than the Incas, because the Incas had only primitive tools. How do we know what tools the Incas have? Also, we find other types of skeletons over there with red hairs, elongated, non-human looking. How do we know what kind of tools those beings had? And they are not those funny skulls. They are not much, much older. So I don't see any problem, because you're asking about the time period of 500 or 600 or 700 years ago. Maybe those beings were building together with the local people, maybe in Peru and everywhere else, these polygonal walls. I don't see any problem with that, because the same, for example, elongated skulls are found in Europe as well. It's just a hypothesis. I'm not saying particularly there is any connection between the elongated skulls and the polygonal megalithic walls, but it's just an option. Also, this dating that I'm saying that they're very young is based on the fact that they're taken out of context, not like in their entirety. The researchers who talk about 12,000 years ago, they don't take into consideration that we have such walls incorporated into medieval fortresses in Japan, in Europe. The French aqueducts, they are also relatively very, very young, just a couple of hundred years ago. Or what to speak of St. Petersburg, the megaliths there are huge, very similar to those of Peru, like identical looks built a few hundred years ago. And in Armenia, also we have amazing polygonal stuff, very hard stone. How did they put it? And it's not just one place, it's a couple of them over there in Turkey, in Armenia. So when we say the date for 12,000 years, we should not exclude all this other stuff. And then we can get the correct idea of everything.
Mm-hmm. So last time we talked and we discussed the elite changing, altering the timeline, restructuring our human history to fit what they want us to know and what justifies their rule. And that's a pretty radical idea that a lot of people were super interested in. But the biggest criticism that people came back at me with was looking at the history of inventions and tools, like from the wheel up to vehicles and rockets and the internet that we have now. It's easy to kind of trace that history, and it's hard to, you know, undo that in our heads, because when we look at these sites that we're talking about, these megalithic sites, they require some high technology to put them together, and we don't find buried cranes anywhere from 700 years ago. We don't find vehicles that might have made tracks in the mud. So I'm curious what you think about that, like how we solve that problem.
I think, first of all, people are a bit with narrow vision, because they always expect higher technology to be very technical, like ours.
Mm-hmm.
While in most cases, probably it was sound-based in the past. And why I say sound-based, it's because of the legends. We always hear about the magical words, how they do things with that. And also with my experience with shamanic things, with sounds, this is the way to do miracles. This is the main way to do miracles. So they could have been using far more advanced techniques than we can imagine. For example, based on sound, and they wouldn't require all of these cranes and stuff. That's the first thing.
Mm.
Second of all, I don't think that most of these, for example, the polygonal masonry megaliths required cranes or these advanced cutting machines, simply because they were cast out of geopolymer.
Mm-hmm.
There is really overwhelming evidence of this coming from many sites. Not only one researcher, there is pretty convincing evidence that that has been the case, mostly.
Which is like advanced concrete for people who don't know, right?
Yeah, advanced concrete. For example, in Peru, we have a lot of cuttings on solid, massive bedrocks that could not have been cast out. And over there we see cutting marks that are absolutely smooth. Now, this may make some people think that they must have used some very advanced cutting machines. But again, this is not the only option. What about this stone melting with sound? It's just one possibility. I'm not saying that they did it in that way. I have no proof, no reason to think so. But the only thing I'm saying, there are other options.
Mm-hmm.
So our style of technology is not the only possible one. This is my main answer. And the second possibility is that if these amazing things in the past were done with technical tools similar to ours, then it is possible that only a small fraction of the society had such tools or access to them.
Mm-hmm.
As it is nowadays, by the way.
Very true.
So if the machines were very few, then it's not difficult that we don't find them.
Mm-hmm.
No wonder that we don't find them.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not saying that any of these hypotheses is true. The only thing I'm trying to prove is that there are other options.
I'm with you.
The lack of cranes doesn't prove that it was only aliens.
Yeah, those are fair points.
And as far as the actual tools that were used, the tools that produced those tool marks that seem above our technology, for example, a circular disc with diameter of 2-3 meters and yet only a couple of millimeters wide. This is far above us. We don't have a material from which we could make such a disc. It would break with the first rotation if we try to. So recently in a Russian laboratory, they examined some of the stones that had on them tool marks of such advanced machinery. They carefully compared them with the marks left by modern circular discs, stone cutting machines. And the conclusion was that the marks left by the old cutting instrument are so fine and they leave such a smooth surface that as if though the stone was not cut using gross material force as our cutting machines, but as if it was disintegrating the material as it goes, as if it was cutting through butter. So the fact that on some old stones we see tool marks that somewhat resemble the tool marks left by current machinery, that should not make us automatically assume that the tools were also like ours. For example, a stone cutting machine with disc, well, with a bit better specifications, but still something similar, an improved model. No, there is no reason to think that it was simply an improved model. Well, at the same time, we do have old descriptions of cutting discs. The name of one of them would be Sudarshana Chakra from the Vedic literature. It is used as a weapon as well and as many other things by Vishnu, Krishna, and other incarnations of the underlying creator spirit of goodness. And so Sudarshana Chakra would travel great distances in no time and perform all kinds of tasks, and nowhere there is any mentions of cables hanging from it. Just on the opposite, it is clearly said it operated with the power of wish, with the power of thoughts, the power of will. Even primitive chaps like us have detected in our laboratories that thoughts do have the power to produce purely material impulses in matter, electromagnetic in nature, so we shouldn't be surprised at all if a disc operates powered by thought. In the Book of Enoch, there are also some descriptions for some sort of old magical machinery, and there is no mention at all that it needed a electric power supply or some sort of gigantic metal structures to support or move the giant stones it was working with. Yet it easily handled, with the power of magic only, absolutely massive stones. For example, the huge megaliths at the basis of the Temple Mount in Jerusalem seem to have been built with the help of such machinery. Sure enough, the reality corresponds to the old book. There is a visibly distinct older layer in the Temple Mount, and it does consist of such gigantic stones that happen to have this techno book, so to say. And needless to say, it was all powered again by magic.
Hmm. Yeah, I love it. We have to think unconventionally and respect some of those descriptions we find in those old texts. And if we're talking about the period of the Reformation, this 1500s era, as the point when these parasites, as you say, took over, Well, that's right in line with the invention of the printing press, the first technology to facilitate the widespread distribution of information. And every other iteration, newspapers, radio, TV, film, it's always been distributed from the top, with plenty of indications that deception and propaganda was used in these mediums from the get-go. Why should the printing press have been any different? And you can almost say that from the shutting down of magic back in the day, and this point where we have the iteration of the printing press right on up to the modern internet, these are the technologies of the parasites and some of the next best options that emerge once the original, more earth-based technologies that we were using for however many years were removed.
Yes, I get your point. Fomenk also makes the point that when they started printing, immediately they started with like very large volumes, like four bricks put together this big. There was no gradual evolution, and immediately they started one abbey printed 100 volumes of something, the other one 200 of history, and the other one 200 more. It wasn't a gradual evolution. What I find very interesting is the way of distributing information in the past according to the description in the Vedas. They talk about times when people needed to hear a given book only once, and then they would memorize every single word of it forever.
Hmm.
So that kind of memory we had thousands of years ago. and then we evolved to what we are now.
Right, devolved down.
Yeah.
You were talking about that 12,000 years ago time period, that very trendy time period in the alternative culture right now, and a lot of the center of that is Göbekli Tepe. And one thing I find interesting is that it's sort of common knowledge that Göbekli Tepe was intentionally buried, but researchers seem to treat that like it's some big mystery. You know, why would they do this? But if a parasitic elite was trying to cover up the past, it seems pretty clear why someone might bury a site like Göbekli Tepe.
Yes, I do agree with you. But in terms of the popularity of Göbekli Tepe, it has gained lots of popularity recently. And that's great, because we have some examples of art that could be very, very old. Possibly the site is really old. Or to be more precise, the older layer with the dinosaur carvings and T-shaped stones, that could be somewhat old. While the other layer that consists of primitive stonework, basically, mostly of undressed stones going in circle and connecting the bigger T-shaped blocks, that seems probably very, very recent to me. It could be even medieval. At least its style resembles that of the Roman and medieval times. And not only it belongs to a distinctly different style of a building, but also this primitive stonework often overlaps the depictions on the old stone of figures of animals, which definitely suggests that these circular walls were not part of the initial design. But also we should not forget that Göbekli Tepe has acquired its recent fame due to mainstream historical dating, which again and again has turned out to be total joke and lies, sometimes clear fraud. We can only make guesses about the age of Göbekli Tepe. It could be old or not. But very few people are aware that we have historic sites that are not very famous and are definitely much more impressive and much, much older. Some examples would be the numerous rock-cut ruins near Atlit in Israel, or Sierra de San Cristobal in Spain, or the Egil castles of Turkey. Now, why am I so confident that they are much, much older? For example, Atlit. those ruins are cut out of solid bedrock. In some cases, that bedrock is a very hard variety of stone. So partially, of course, they are covered with soil, but at places they were exposed. And over there, you can clearly see how parts of the buildings, part of the walls, have been eaten up by erosion. And they're smoothened in such a way that it is absolutely crystal clear that it is not that some chunk of the wall fall in earthquake. It was only erosion, most definitely. Now, in reality, if we have to be honest, we have absolutely no clue what is the speed of erosion even. The mainstream estimations are total fantasy. But we can make a very important parallel with the Peruvian polygonal megaliths, for example, because some of them are also made of a very hard variety of granite. Now, those megaliths have been exposed to the weather at least for couple of thousand years, at least 500 years, let's say, if not much, much longer, which is also possible, and still they look brand new, as if built yesterday. On most of the famous Peruvian polygonal megaliths, the visible signs of erosion are simply not there. So just imagine, in relation to that, how long would have been at least rock cut ruins exposed to the weather, so that entire parts of the wall, in some cases few meters high, would get eaten up by the erosion. And when I say rock-cut ruins, please don't imagine some sort of grotto like those of the primitive men of Stone Age, as we are showed, like Fred and Barney. I'm talking about absolutely massive walls, the height of a few stories, maybe 10 meters high. And then in Spain, we have Sierra de San Cristobal, which is made in a style absolutely identical to that of the ruins of Atlit. Same 6-10 meters high walls that appear to be remains as if they were surrounding some sort of assembly halls or maybe gardens, but probably not, because also underground they are vast halls with very high ceilings. And all that stretches for many square kilometers is just absolutely vast and huge. It's close to the public. Access is difficult or impossible, also very deep shafts. And even if you get inside, if you attempt to get to the really big portions of the underground parts of it, and then sooner or later you see a modern wall just cutting your access off.
So what I want to say is, I'm not saying that there wasn't advanced civilization 12,000 years ago, but they were not building polygonal megaliths for sure.
That's interesting. Yeah. And so, you know, we mentioned earlier, just so everybody's clear, we mentioned earlier that some of these sites that we're told are thousands of years old might actually only be hundreds of years old. What do you think the oldest structures that we can see are? How old do you think the oldest ones might be that we can see?
Oh, I have no clue, but the ones I mentioned in Israel could be the oldest I can think of right now. They look similarly eroded to these Aegil castles of Turkey and all these rock cut ruins that belong to the same. The Aegil castles, they belong to the style that I was researching in Italy and in Spain. And those in Israel are slightly different. But the Israeli ones could be a bit older, because some of them are made of very hard variety of stone. While in Turkey and in Italy, they were mostly cut into tufa stones, which means compressed, hardened volcanic ash.
Okay.
So that's sometimes very soft.
Right on. So it's very hard to put any kind of date on these things, because there's really no dating method that you would really trust that's out there, right?
I trust a certain dating method, but I can't find enough people to extract information about it. As I have said many times, the way to find out our true history is through trance states. The easiest available way to do it now, available method to do it nowadays, are the past life regressions. If regressionists from all over the world gather together and start recording pieces of history told by their clients, we can recover the true history very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Because when unrelated people from different continents start telling a story about certain historic event, then most likely that's how it was. It is very easy to recover our history. It's just a question of making the people aware how to do it and then doing it.
Well, I know that you're also very well-versed in ayahuasca and the spiritual realm and communicating with entities that might be on that side. Have you talked to any entities that might give you insights into the past, like Shiva or some of the other ones I've heard you mention before?
No, unfortunately, I don't feel I'm very well versed in these things. That's the main problem. And that's why I need to go on expeditions to find out the truth. No, I have never spoken with any entity regarding history. I have had a couple of very brief historic visions, and I'm not as good in ayahuasca as I should be. I'm excellent compared to the average level on Earth now. Then you can say I'm very well versed, but otherwise, I think I know nothing about it, unfortunately, from my perspective.
Understood. You're being pretty humble, of course, but you do plan to continue down the path of ayahuasca insights and experiences, right? I mean, maybe in some type of teaching capacity?
Yes, this is how I envision my old age when I'm 70 or 80, just conducting ceremonies. What else to do? You know, old people, they don't require so much sleep.
Right.
But in terms of plans for the foreseeable future, some friends of mine are actually trying to open a fully legitimate ayahuasca center here in the so-called advanced world. And if that happens, I will be glad to join them and help. Not necessarily in a capacity of a shaman, because being a shaman is not as glamorous and exotic a job as it may seem to many people. To some, it may seem to be only about smoking aromatic herbs in a fancy pipe and chatting casually with angels, fluffing their wings around you. But this is so far from the truth. This line is thinking is like that of a person who thinks, oh, I will become a surgeon so that I can watch naked chicks all my life. You will be seeing something radically different on the surgical table all your life if you become a surgeon. And in a similar way, becoming a shaman means daily encountering, dragging out of people the ugliest and most nasty creatures that you can't even see in this world. But I do believe that making ayahuasca available for everybody who wishes that is probably the fastest way to raise the level of the consciousness of the planet. I'm not saying ayahuasca is the only spiritual practice or that it is the best spiritual practice, but I definitely think it is the one that delivers the fastest results. For example, you may go to some Buddhist gathering or seminar or yoga, something of that sort, and they will tell you that you are a particle of this underlying creator spirit, and that if you conduct your daily activities from this point of view, instead of the egoistic one that is always profit-oriented, Then gradually your consciousness will be emancipated. It will be, but it will take ages, because after this seminar you will return home, and you are likely sooner or later to face problems like having to go to unpleasant work for many hours. Then you start thinking, where is this underlying creator spirit? If he was so full in love and I'm a particle of him, how come I ended in this unpleasant situation, and why doesn't the spirit come to help me pay my rent so that I can find some time and meditate on him? And so one would slide back in the modern so-called normal way of life, which is full of sadness, depression, bitterness, arrogance, disappointment, and so on. But ayahuasca is a radically different type of teacher. It will not give you lectures, nor it will tell you what to do. It will simply take you by the hand and show you in absolutely straightforward and practical terms that you are an infinite spirit made of love. For many people, this would happen within the first few ceremonies. Others may need much more sessions, but eventually it does happen to everybody. And then as the student of ayahuasca perceives more and more how his own being is woven from this material, this underlying goodness, one doesn't need to be told how to change one's ways and behavior and intentions and priorities. It happens automatically. It's just a normal sequence of understanding who you are. Now and then I get letters of concern from some of the viewers of my YouTube channel. They would go like this: I love your historic videos, but I'm concerned about your soul because you drink ayahuasca and evil spirits are talking to you. Yes, I absolutely guarantee and confirm this and tell this openly. If you drink ayahuasca, sooner or later, you're sure to meet one spirit, evil spirit. Most probably it will be very evil, and I can tell you who it is exactly. That's your own dark side. And as far as our dark side, I'm aware of only four options. The first one is to face it, understand what does it feed on, and then dissolve it by giving it no more food and transforming yourself into angel. The second option is to know that you have a dark side, but to be afraid to face it. The third one is, out of stupid pride, to convince yourself that you do not have any dark side at all. And the fourth one is to actually embrace it and lead some sort of devilish existence even while you're in a human form.
Damn, that is interesting. I guess we all have a dark side we're going to have to do something with, ayahuasca or not. And another tool for insight into the true history that you had mentioned last time was remote viewing. Have there been any advancements on that front at all since we last talked?
I'm still trying hard. I'm left only with one remote viewer, Mike Herberts. He's a good viewer. Just a few days ago, I gave him a target. It's now revealed, so I can tell you. It was these high towers in Tibet.
Right on.
So I'm just giving you an example of how is our remote viewing project going on. And he got back to me. He described Lhasa very well. He even mentioned that these are the people of Tibet. He was so close to the target. Hmm. He described the village and everything, but he never saw the towers.
Wow.
Definitely remote viewing can be of use, but with one person, I can still do relatively very little. I was feeling as if he's watching from the towers, so he sees everything else around himself.
Very well could be. And you mentioned past life regressionists. I know you interviewed Peter Petrov, past life regressionist from Bulgaria, and I really liked that interview. And with this reconstruction, what sorts of insights have you gotten from his work into people's past lives? Are there certain patterns that are forming, or certain revelations people have said about their past lives that you found particularly insightful?
Particularly insightful? I don't have new information from him, but I remember, for example, other past life regressions I have read. For example, some lady was recollecting how probably 1,000 years ago, I'm 99% sure, she was whatever, sister of a priest, high priest in Egypt. And even as close as 1,000 years ago, they were having that high magic or technology, I don't know if you can call it that way, that they were trying to even resurrect dead people to put them back in their bodies. They were, at least those who were educated, the priests, they could go in and out of their body at will. And the main thing about these past life regressions is what was important for the people in the past. It wasn't so much the cell phones and gadgets. That's why we have difficulty understanding and we tend to make wrong guesses about how and why things were, because we have absolutely different priorities compared to them. We don't understand their mindset. That is the main problem.
Mm-hmm.
Once we start understanding what is spirituality, because from my point of view, people don't even know what is spirituality all about. Some think it's some faith in fantasy or believing in ghosts or believing in something. It's actually spirituality is understanding who you are, what is your soul. But people have not only turned away from it, they don't even know what is it nowadays. So I think when we start understanding what it is and start feeling that it is interesting, then the history may open for us.
Right. Very well could be. And I also wanted to talk to you about the evidence for ancient wars or really powerful weapons and the destruction of areas, because this is talked about sometimes in alternative circles, and usually they cite the sand glass as possible evidence of this. But I've heard critics say that a meteor could also cause that to form, but there are other pieces of evidence of ancient weaponry used outside of that, right?
Can I answer from a very high perspective mystical one?
Please.
You know, even when a comet falls, this can be a weapon itself. Because in the way the gods were fighting, even according to legends, they would throw celestial bodies, or gods or demons, it's maybe a more suitable word. The demons would throw entire celestial bodies at our planet. And in addition to that, everything is penetrated by this all-pervasive consciousness. Even the meteor is not dead.
Well, that's a fair point. As hard as it might be to attribute damage to either a natural disaster or a technological weapon of some kind, it might not even matter if you think everything has consciousness and there are unseen forces influencing events. It gets almost impossible to separate the two. But in terms of the evidence of some kind of weapon, there are areas like the old Indus Valley civilization that I've heard you talk about, where it looks like many people died suddenly en masse in the streets, where skeletons are preserved huddled up as if they were running from something that wiped them all out. And that's pretty odd, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, probably it was a result of some weapon, because that's what we read in the history of that region. Actually, that region has a remarkably well-preserved written history, the Vedic literature. So over there, the finds perfectly correspond to the history of the region. Those who consider it to be a fantasy and legend, that's their problem. I see no ambiguity over there. Everything fits perfectly.
Another one I really liked that was new to me that I learned about in your videos was the Lake of Svityas, I think if I'm pronouncing it right. The local legend said there was a city there, but now there's just a lake.
Yeah, this is how we'll find our history. So this boy, he's not even into history. He's just developing his mystic powers. He sees things in dreams. He had some feeling, inside feeling, that there was a town here, some feelings. He saw some people screaming and this and that. And he went to the museum and he found out that indeed there was a town here on the old maps. And the people disappeared under a suspiciously round hole. And then the local legends say that after this happened, anybody who went to that wretched place and touched anything there was also getting very sick and dying. And the symptoms were very similar to those of somebody who would have been in contact with radiation. So this is really a superb example of how we can, of how even non-historians discover pieces of the history.
Yeah, I love that. It's like we need to trust our modern shamans. But that lake story was so interesting because apparently old maps don't have the lake there. They actually have the city and all the surrounding areas are as they're thought to be. And apparently this was 200 or 300 years ago that some of these maps have a city there. And that really does kind of give credence to your position that a lot of these ruins or the destruction of cities wasn't as far back as people say.
Yes. And now to return back to the Italy expedition, a very perplexing thing for all of us who were there, we were like 12, 13 people, is these rock cut ruins, we consider them, they look pre-flood because they're multi-storied often, and entire stories of them are just clogged with clay, covered with earth layers. Hmm. It's not some sort of historic, what they call it, cultural layers with some ceramic. It's just pure clay, few meters high, on one side, which looks like great flood to me. And we saw this all over. And yet, on the other hand, the tool marks on many of them were very, very fresh. And this is on a relatively soft variety of stone. This is very perplexing, actually. And not only they look pre-flood, but also like these streets, these rock-cut streets, in many cases, they end abruptly at very high cliffs. And below are forests and valleys and villages, medieval villages. So obviously these are very old ruins from the destruction of how the earth layers were turning. And on the other side, on the sides of these rock-cut streets, which were which were used for a long time, which are even still in use, we see very fresh cutting tool marks. This is quite mysterious, and that is on soft stone. So, yeah.
Interesting. It is a lot. And, you know, we were talking about the idea of massive destruction. I have speculated, I'm curious if you have any thoughts on it, but I wonder if the recovery of ancient weapons or lost knowledge could be the reason why there's still all this fighting for control of the Middle East in modern times. Might there be secrets still left uncovered, or potentially technology or weaponry, even if it's just things that are written about? I wonder if that isn't part of the subtext for why there's so much fighting with the superpowers over that region.
Could be, but I don't have any information about this.
Fair. And on this kind of same theme of destroyed cities and cultures we know nothing about, I've heard you say that the biggest country that seems to have been removed from history entirely is one called Tartaria, if I'm pronouncing it right, that is somewhere in modern Russia?
Tartaria. Yes. Well, it was much bigger initially. It was covering probably most of the earth in the beginning. And later on, it got broken into pieces. Maybe Fomenko sees Russia as its center because he's a Russian himself.
Mm.
But in reality, pieces of it fought, became independent under different names. Some of them were in Patagonia, in Ethiopia, certainly in Siberia were some of them. They were fighting longer than the others. But yes, this country is on all all the maps. Its flag is included in a number of medieval lists of flags.
Mm.
Its kings, like the dynasties of its kings, are described in historic books. There is no reason to doubt that it was a country, and yet it's just missing from the modern history textbooks. No?
That's so fascinating. I love that kind of mystery. And I mean, it does show that such a huge thing can be covered up and just removed from the culture entirely if they choose to do that. And I love also looking at ancient maps. We talked about several the last time you were here, but this is one of the best ways to learn about missing civilizations, right?
Yes, and particularly the maps of the sailors, because the maps that were on land, they got mostly destroyed during the Reformation. But because those who were carrying out the cleanup had, you know, it's practically difficult to go out in the seas and hunt the ships to search them for maps. That's why the old navigation maps are most revealing.
And I was also going to ask you if you've looked at or if you've heard of Friesland, because I've had a few guests who have shown me some maps that have another landmass near Iceland and Greenland that had cities mapped out on it. It had the capital on it, and they called it Friesland, and it's just not there anymore.
Friesland?
Yeah. Maybe you're not familiar. Maybe that's a new
maybe.
One.
Maybe.
I'll send
maybe.
You some links.
Yes.
Man, I really do love talking to you because you're a real gateway between the English speaking world and a lot of researchers that are kind of behind the language barrier, like Fomenko to some degree and like Kultepin. And are there other researchers like them that don't reach American audiences that you're deriving a lot of your research from that you could tell us about?
Yes, for example, this boy Kuznetsov that discovered these tracks in near Derenkuyu, the video I published a few days ago.
Mm-hmm.
He's very nice. Subotin, Nikolai Subotin, he's also very, very cool. And of course, the king of all Russian researchers is Vadim Chernobrov.
Hmm.
So Vadim Chernobrov, he is also very, very interesting, probably the most famous in Russia. But it's very strange. He makes expeditions and he does not publish the results. One needs to wait a few years for some TV or radio interview to hear about fantastic stuff, and then a couple of more years to get photos of it, because he does not publish any of the photos on his website. I often wonder why is he doing all this research. But the things he discovers are really fascinating, and he's very, very meticulous in his study. No speculation, no strange stuff. He's really very good. Vadim Chernobrov.
Interesting. I will look him up. Another thing that came up in the Kultepin interview and some of your work is the idea of non-humans living in the past. You found several structures that seem to have been elf castles. At least that's what you're referring to them as, right?
Yeah, the elf castles. Now this is interesting and new. The elf castles, Kultepin came up with this name because they look magical, as if taken out from a fairy tale. But I think, well, actually they were for humans. Now, what I saw in Italy, one of these, what I call layers of rock cut ruins, because they belong to several groups, one of them, just out there in the forest, they look as if really elves lived there. They have a particular flavor to them. They're like secluded, usually just one or two rooms, with some very strange tunnels next to them or on the backside.
Hmm.
Always with fantastic views from the window and somewhat low ceilings. And with this, the most cute steps on the side. If you go there, you will feel as if you're in a fairy tale. If I did not have a group with me of people who wanted to research history, I would just remain there and sing Om and not go to other historic sites. We did some of that Om singing in the isolated caves. We had a very good didgeridoo player in the group. It was truly magical. And then when you see this with the high trees around, with the Marita muscaria growing around, just the feeling was, I was surprised that one can visit a fairy tale, real one, so near to Rome.
Hmm.
And all this was found by our local guide, Simon, who in the beginning was telling me that you will be disappointed by the holes where we keep our shovels.
Man, I was also impressed by the Cave of Swimmers in Egypt, where there's some curious rock art that depicts mermaids, it seems.
Yeah, that somebody submitted that to the directory. I'm not surprised.
You also have a video talking about, while we're on the subject of non-humans, dwarves living in Siberia not that long ago, and the people used to have regular communication and trade with them, apparently. What can you tell us about that? That's pretty far out for some people to hear, I think.
Yes, when one spends one's life in a matchbox, then an object like a car will seem so gigantic that it will be like a fairy tale.
Mm-hmm.
So what else can I say? I'm sure that's true because I myself saw tunnels in Spain, in Austria, where they're non-human. No, it's no way you can pass through, what to speak of shoveling stone or digging it.
Hmm.
Well, I don't know what to recommend to people who cannot imagine it just because it seems so weird for them. If they drink ayahuasca 100 times, that may help them.
I believe that. But apparently in this Siberian area, you say in the video that diplomatic connections between the dwarves and the humans was severed in the 18th century. And obviously before that, we traded with them, we talked to them. How do we know that connection was severed in the 18th century? Is that from the local people?
Yeah, that's from the local people. Yeah, definitely. And in the wild areas, these tribes, there are a couple of them. They're similar. Some of them were dwarves. Some were people that when we started going the technological way, when we started changing a lot, some certain groups of people decided not to go that way, but remain in the wild, not to lose their magical powers. And they started mixing with all these tribes that were still doing magic. So who lives still in the tunnels? We don't know. But the source of this information, the diplomatic relations, so to say, I mean, just exchanging messages about trading metal stuff, that is from the local people. Yes, definitely. And those who lead more traditional life in these areas till nowadays, if you ask them, these Chut tribes and others, these are dwarves. But if you read like mainstream books, they will tell you, oh, these were normal people. These were just the ancestors of the people that live there now. But if you go to the people that live there now, they will tell you, no, these are the dwarves. Sometimes they kidnapped our children to, take them. They don't even like them very much. They feel offended when somebody suggests that these were their ancestors. No, these are our enemies. They were, they were doing magic on us and things like that. So
that's interesting. Do we know, I guess we don't really know exactly why the connection was severed, or do we have any writing or anything from them?
Writing from the dwarves?
Yeah.
No, we don't have writing, but we have artifacts. this kind of small iron, how you call them, pieces of art.
Right, little figurines, it looked like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, figurines, yeah. Mm. Yeah.
And
that's all we have.
Are we to assume that the dwarves are still alive somewhere underground?
Yes, occasionally there are meetings recorded that they may talk to people who, for example, hunters or some strange tourists who venture in really wild areas. Now and then they will meet a dwarf.
I also thought it was interesting that they say that they found some copper areas and they started developing copper mines and found out that these mines had already been excavated and mined out a long time ago, probably by these dwarf civilizations.
Yeah, that's what triggered these actually scientific expeditions in Russia to Siberia. When they started developing their metal industry in the regions, the ore places were all already opened. And so they gathered the best scientists at that time in Russia and sent them on a couple of expeditions to find out what's going on there. So they went and found out and wrote their reports. And fortunately, these reports are still available in some Russian universities. They are not taught as part of history, but some students fortunately had access to them, could read them, and that's how we could find out about them.
Yeah, I find that stuff really interesting because it's such evidence that somebody was there before and that they were there long enough ago that we don't even remember it, that it seems like completely foreign to us. And have you found anything else in the way of ancient quarries or advanced mining operations, anything like that, that really seems like a big operation of high technology from the past that doesn't fit with the official story?
So the best example, the most applicable site to this topic would be the Longyu Grottoes of China. That's their official name. Hmm. Just a couple of mountain peaks are literally made hollow inside, and the tool marks on the walls are one-to-one, same as our modern heavy equipment for mining. And officially they are declared a mystery, so problem solved. They are opened for public access. One can visit them, but that's it.
I know there's a lot of people looking into the idea of ancient quarries and stuff right now. I've had some people send me this video that is trying to make the case that the Grand Canyon is actually some ancient mining operation. And that's, I don't know about that one.
I don't know about the Grand Canyon, but what I found most intriguing is this in the Gulf of Mexico. Those strange marks on the bottom of the enclosed body of water. Hmm. I don't know if you saw them there in one of the episodes about what I call old earth ruins.
Hmm.
That is the most convincing one because it's on the bottom and, yeah.
It's under the water.
What else to say? Mm-hmm. Deep underwater.
And that's pretty common too. I mean, pretty much across the coastlines of every major continent, we can find something that is right there under the water that suggests that at a previous time, there was a civilization on the old coast that was right there.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty common. So another thing that you talk about fairly often is the idea that before the parasites, we were a much more cohesive species. You know, we were much more international and we had the kind of communication and travel that the mainstream says we didn't have. They say we were all just isolated pockets. And one piece of evidence that I just recently heard about from your videos is this runic writing that is apparently found in Europe, Asia, Africa, and in the Americas to some extent. You say they're officially labeled as independent systems to hide our, you know, one big family. Can you tell us anything more about this seemingly universal language or these rune writings, these runic writings?
I'm not sure. It doesn't really have an official name. In terms of runic, maybe it's pre-runic. The closest name that maybe some scholars try to put to it is pre-Sanskrit. That would be the keyword for this type of writing. It predates the runes. The runes are similar to it, but a later development of it. And definitely, I showed examples from Southeast Asia, definitely a lot of it in South and North America, of course, tons of it in Europe and the Middle East. These artifacts, they're not secret as such. Their existence is not disputed. They're found all over museums and officially accepted historic sites, but simply nobody pays attention that we have the same writing all over the place. How come?
Yeah, that's the mystery. But finding that, I mean, that really does help give credibility to this idea of a unified, peaceful past before a parasitic invasion and the Reformation period got us all out of whack. So hearing about that, it only strengthens the case.
Interestingly enough, similar type of writing showed on the underwater video cams that were filming the pyramid off the coast of Cuba, that is some 60 meters below sea level. And I found an interview that was taken from the archaeologists that were conducting the research, and the interview was taken when this writing was first spotted. At that time, they were already talking about similarities to various ancient European alphabets and so on, and connecting with various experts in languages, in old languages. But then in the interviews that were taken from them the subsequent years, they would deny answering questions about this writing. They would just skip the answers, and when pressed harder, they would say the waters were murky, we don't know what was it.
And earlier you mentioned the kind of the resonance of some of these sites, the possibility of sound technology. And I'm with you. I actually got to experience a little bit of this in Armenia when I was there looking at some ancient sites on a tour last year. There were some singers in a couple of specific locations that were really impressive, and I'm pretty energetically dense. And so for me to feel a change in energy is pretty rare. And I thought that was really impressive. Also, Alexander, when we talked to him, he got into the idea that he was looking at reverse engineering some of the ancient vibroacoustic healing techniques. What do you know about that work or about sound technology in the past and the possibility of it being a healing mechanism?
It was surely used as a healing, that is no doubt. But unfortunately, I myself don't know of any details how it was done. Mm-hmm. In terms of creating spaces, how were they calculating, how was this tuning done? I don't know any details about that. I have very little first-hand experience of influencing the events around by singing as done by the shamans. In terms of that, maybe I have some insights, but in terms of how a certain space could be tuned to do a specific thing, I'm not aware of anybody who knows how is this done exactly.
Mm-hmm. It does seem fairly lost, but in the part where you talk about that in one of your videos, you bring up the Bulgarian death stones, and I thought this was pretty interesting because they seem to swallow up sound. There are cavities on the side of walls that seem to maybe capture sound, and the suggestion is that they could have been regulators or used for tuning, the way you've seen people, I'm sure listeners have seen people who have a table set up and they have a bunch of different glasses of water filled to different levels, and then they can tap on them and they make different chimes. It almost seemed like something similar could have gone on this wall, where you fill in some of the holes to make certain sounds and leave others open to get to a certain type of tuning, but that structure, I felt like I could really see some type of sound technology coded there, like some kind of, giant rock organ or something.
Could be. At this stage, this is only a speculation.
Right.
And also, even if a certain hole has these special acoustic properties, it doesn't mean this was exactly a healing hole. Or, like, imagine we disappear and some archaeologists in a far distant future find the church and see all the paintings on the walls and say, oh, this was surely an art gallery. No, it wasn't an art gallery. Art was just a part of the full thing. Nor it was a concert hall, although people were singing all the time here. It was a church. So certainly a lot of the old, very old buildings have special acoustic properties, but this doesn't mean that they were all special therapy rooms. Probably they had art all over and acoustic properties and so many other things. That is my general impression.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is a great example with the church and how that might be looked at from the future. And also, in several of your videos, you observe architectural styles that don't seem to be consistent with the official history. What insights have you gotten to help piece the story back together just by looking at the various architecture?
Currently, I'm on the wavelength of seeing similarities. Just the last few days, I've been collecting all these images for the future documentary, showing how absolutely the same style of these rock cut ruins was all the way from the Middle East to Spain. But you're asking me for architectural styles that don't fit. Can you clarify a little bit?
Well, one example is you show a picture and you say, where would you think this is from? And it's a black and white photo and it looks like something European, but it's actually Japan. And you're like, well, how did that happen?
Okay, now you're talking about the so-called neoclassical architectural style. Yes, there is a lot of that in Japan and in South America. If they show you just one picture and tell you that colonialists built all this, you may agree. But if you look at the full story, like in Japan, who could have built it at which time period, it doesn't match at all, because Japan was completely closed to the world when people were building such things. So how come it was there? And it opened later on, when this style was going out of fashion, and also these are like the central parts of its main cities. So what did they demolish? All houses and call some foreigners to build buildings in a style that is going out of fashion? And in South America, it's not only the style, but mostly the statues, really Roman-looking statues of women showing private parts, men showing even more. Mm-hmm. And they're telling us that Christian missionaries made all that? This is such a big joke. I mean, like the king of the seas, Neptune, he's wearing only one leaf. And we are told that Christian missionaries who were burning people alive made this and put it in the center of their village in front of the cathedral. This is such a joke. So, yes, and such architecture would look very much misplaced if we believe the mainstream history. But if we take into consideration that Tartaria was falling into parts at that time, and different bits and pieces of this country were still keeping the old way of building, old gods, and we're making statues of them, then it all makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't need all these jokes here and there to explain the existence of certain architectural style.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to look for clues into what the true history might be. I'm also curious, you know, we hear that there's pyramids all over the world. Of course, we've seen plenty of examples of that. But you also talk about this ancient underground megalith at Kabardino, Bulgaria, which seems to be a close match for the size and design of the Great Pyramid of Giza. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, that is really a remarkable find and dig. Vadim Chernobrov is excavating this since years. And yeah, it was in the beginning they thought it's only a shaft. But then when they started looking at the stones of this so-called hill, it came out that they are actually megaliths densely overgrown by vegetation. Just megalithic blocks, huge ones, put next to each other. And the local people also, for some reason, say that this is a man-made hill.
Hmm.
This is very interesting. It's the size of the Great Pyramid of Giza. And after they found out that actually the full hill is artificial, I don't know if it is exactly pyramidal. It looks like a hill. Then there is some clue at least how these shafts inside were made. Otherwise, I mean, just a tiny hole inside very big blocks. How could they get them in? It looked really too weird. But after it became clear that these are only tunnels in a hill, then, yes, at least that much is clear. This is huge. It is big historic site. It is important.
Right.
It deserves attention, and it is getting attention. After the discovery, now this village has turned into a tourist spot. Hundreds, probably thousands of people come all the time now. It's very famous.
It is very impressive, and you're right. It looks more like a hill rather than a pyramid, but when you put the diagrams of the inside of the Great Pyramid versus this new megalithic site, the inside chambers are what's so close to being identical. Has there been any insight gained from their function out since it's outside of the influence of the Egyptologist gatekeepers?
No, there is. It looks like some sort of industrial setup or something. It looks like all these tunnels in Egypt. And that's how it feels, and that is how much we know about it as well.
Fair enough. Yeah, there's so little known. Another series you worked on that I found really interesting was on prophecies of famous seers of the past. Do you find any consistent predictions or prophecies from these people that have given you added insight into either what has happened in the past or where we might be going?
Yes. Recently, I published a documentary on the prophecies of Otrok Vyacheslav and putting them together with the previous set of prophecies that I consider credible, which are mostly based on Slava Sivrukova, the prophecies of Slava Sivrukova from Bulgaria. So combining all that, I see that they are consistent with each other, and I still think that they show the most probable timeline that is about to happen. Again, according to both of them, this is just the most likely thing to happen. It is not going to surely happen, all of it. They say some parts are sure, some are not. But it still remains the most likely. And what you have not seen on my channel yet is that I'm inspired by this new information. I made a survey, and I surveyed my viewers, the viewers of my channel, with the various questions. And the one that was most important for me out of all these questions was, in case this full story with the Mark of the Beast really does happen, and there is really this offer to get marked on the forehead, on the head, with some sort of... So the question is, imagine this really happens. Will you accept the Mark of the Beast?
Sure, okay.
And I was unpleasantly surprised to find out that only below, 38% of the people only selected no way. All the others had explanations and philosophizing and all kinds of something else. That was very sad for me, actually.
Yikes. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think we are ready for it.
Yeah, we might be. If over half the people taking just an online survey when they're not even under any pressure are willing to say that they'd accept the Mark of the Beast in some revelation sense, that's definitely got to make you think twice.
And speaking in terms of practical events, because I guess this would be the most interesting part for the listeners of this show, the events will develop like this, according to the prophecies, not according to me. And despite all the cheap talk about peace and wishing peace for the whole planet, the West, or at least certain groups, certain countries of the Western world, will continue supply weapons directly or indirectly to the parties that they themselves, the suppliers, call bad guys. Eventually, this problem with Syria will spread like a disease, like a contagion in the region, and Israel will be attacked and defeated. Probably sometime before that or around that time, on the other hand, China will take over large parts of Russia, if not most of it. So Russia will remain a relatively small country in the very near future, according to some prophets. And on the top of all that, the earth will be more and more unstable, not only in terms of earthquakes, but also giant faults will start appearing. An abyss would suddenly open below people's feet, literally, and sometimes even the vehicles and persons will fall in it. That problem will be so severe and so widespread that it will destroy a significant part of our infrastructure, and that includes laboratories where all kinds of nasty diseases are bred. So those will start spreading amongst people. And it's exactly those diseases that will drastically reduce the population of the planet. In terms of timing, these particular most dramatic events probably should come sometime between year 2025 and 2032. But even as early as year 2022, Slava Sivrikova remarks that the situation in Europe will be already quite difficult, and there will be pretty bad economical crisis by then. That's about Europe. About USA, Vyacheslav Krishaninnikov mentioned that they will be the last one to accept the euro as their currency. I'm just gathering bits and pieces of various prophecies and try to construct the big picture, because many of the prophecies are actually regional. So after the takeover of Jerusalem, the place would be vandalized by the invaders, and this will greatly anger God. And not only God, because by then the Antichrist should have appeared, or he would appear sometime in that period, and most of the people would have accepted the Mark of the Beast by then. But not all of them. Some of them will remain unmarked, and gradually there will be really two different types of people on earth. The differences between them will be so sharp that it will be just intolerable. It will manifest in polarizing the world in two political camps. Basically, one of them will fight on the side of the Antichrist and the other one on the side of goodness. Some countries, like USA and Germany, will be actually split in two, because half will fight on one side and half on the other. One of the side of these two political camps will start from parts of US, going eastwards, all the way to Scandinavia, then parts of Germany, Eastern Europe, Austria, and parts of Italy. The information about these two camps is not exactly from Otrok Vyacheslav, but from another Orthodox saint, Serafim Sarovsky. So all this war will be around Jerusalem, and fortunately the good guys will win in this war. But this will be not the end of all evil on earth. This will be only one of the more difficult periods, starting around year 2025. There will be couple more of such difficult periods, and hopefully by the end of this century, goodness will finally win completely, and the building of the new age will finally start. There will be plenty of work for those who survive, for example, planting trees to revive the devastated planet. And during these turbulent times, the most lives will be lost due to sickness, but for those who remain alive, the main problem will be lack of water. And Otrok Vyacheslav clearly warned that he doesn't mean drinking or clean water, he means any water whatsoever. He says that the water in the oceans and the rivers will turn into some nasty smelling substance that will be difficult to swallow even after boiling many times. And his main message was for those who wish not to get marked with the 666 mark of the beast, which according to him should be happening very, very soon, within a decade or maximum couple of decades. And he clearly and repeatedly said that the only way to avoid it for sure is to live in the forest, in the wilderness. Because if you want to maintain any connection with civilization, probably even driving your car or shopping in the supermarket, you will have to get marked at the checkout or the payment point. Or sometimes he even mentioned that towards the end, people will be forcibly stopped on the highways and marked even against their will. He said that the technology behind this marking won't be, because some people who get marked will try to literally cut it off from his body afterwards, but it will be implanted in each and every cell of their body, something like, I don't know, a nanotechnology, something of that sort. Otrok Vyacheslav also spoke about concerts. The Antichrist will be very actively performing magical entertainment programs all over the world, and those who attend them, according to Vyacheslav, will be marked just by attending.
Hmm. Damn. That does not sound good. But it's definitely interesting to hear what these prophets and seers around the world are saying, and it's great to have that synthesized for us. I guess what can we really do but hope they're wrong? And the question of prophecy, it does bring up that dichotomy between free will and destiny. And in your video, you say that based on the pulling together of information from these various seers and enlightened people, the ratio they seem to come up with most often is that roughly 70% of our lives are predestined, and the remaining 30% is where we have the flexibility and the choice and the free will to stay distracted or do what we came here to do, or, of course, not do it. Does that sound about right to you?
Yes, this 70% was the estimation I got from really good astrologers from India and based on Vedic literature. Now, a new development in this area was what Peter Petrov told me. He told me now that the new age is coming. Some certain souls rather many of them, like the new generation, they are getting born with far less percentage being fixed.
Really?
That's what he said. I don't know if it is true, because he was he's himself really very much into this free will thing, and he gives stress. But there could be something like that. I don't think he just makes it up.
Right, right.
He says that different souls have different percentage of their lives fixed. But I strongly disagree that there is a conflict between free will and something being predestined, because this topic has been brought up thousands of times during past life regressions, and so many people have confirmed the very same thing, that we are free within certain set limit, and the limit we set ourselves before being born, it's all a free will. So I don't see any contradiction, and especially I see no such contradiction after I had a near-death experience myself and decided to come back. It was a very short one, but at that point, out of my own will, I decided to come back to this actually difficult world to live in. Now I regret that I did that, but but from that perspective, the few short moments that I had to look at my life from a completely different perspective, the very same perspective that all people that have a similar experience describe, it looks much different from when you are over there. Incomparably different. Especially after this occasion, I don't see any contradiction between a free will and things being predestined.
Fair enough. I thought it was an interesting point that he talked about. If you're trying to determine what in your life is predestined and what isn't, if you are paying close attention and being mindful, you'll recognize things that seem outside of your control, the outside forces that tend to act on your life or steer you in a certain direction. Those things would be the elements of destiny, or the things put in place to try to channel you towards your destiny. I thought that was kind of interesting.
Well, I don't know. Maybe I could have quoted somebody saying something like that, but I personally don't fully agree with this. Because the most important thing that we are here to learn, and this is from my shamanic experiences, is how to master creating living situations with our thoughts and intentions. And these things that seem to be out of our control, like volcano covering our house with ash, or a car accident that makes us disabled for a life. Even such unpleasant events, they are actually manifestation of thoughts and beliefs that we have had in this life or previous ones. And the main thing that I'm trying to learn, and I think everybody should learn, is how exactly to use these tools that we have of manipulating the surroundings with our thoughts. And if a brick falls on our head, this is just a sign that we are doing and thinking something wrong.
That's an interesting take.
And this is not only my personal opinion. This is also the most important point, according to Seth, in his Seth books of Jane Roberts, which I consider the most holy writing that is available to the general public at the moment on Earth.
All right. Well, that might be some material to pay attention to then. Earlier, you had mentioned your near-death experience, and I wanted to ask you, how similar was that to an ayahuasca session? Because there are a lot of researchers that lump near-death experiences in with the psychedelic experience, and I'm just curious, were there any notable differences you could relay to us?
They were very similar, and that's why I was not shocked, or I just figured out in a few seconds what's going on, actually. And my first thought was, aha, so that's how it feels to die.
Wow.
I wasn't particularly shocked because I've been in such states many times before. Certain ayahuasca ceremonies can feel exactly the same as a near-death experience. Not every ayahuasca ceremony will feel like that, but some of them can.
Hmm. Did you see a tunnel of white light, or did you see your ancestors, those kind of things that people talk about?
No, I did not go that far. Mine was very, very short, and the being that came and cured me, because I had a severe sickness overnight from which I probably died. I cannot confirm it because I didn't have doctors coming and all that. It was all very quick and short. But the being that came and cured me, it was very much the full thing was a big, big lesson for me. It was very personal. It was the last being that I would have expected to come and help me. Maybe the only one that I didn't expect. It was quite interesting, but it's just too personal to share all details.
Fair, fair enough. I respect that. So I also wanted to bring up the new chronology a little bit more, talk about the idea that it was all covered up and switched. I mean, we've talked about the megaliths and how you can kind of get a better sense of the true history. You can tell that it definitely doesn't fit with the official narrative. And in this realm, you know, last time we did spend so much time talking about how this manipulation could happen, that Jesuit priests like Scaliger were really the people who put this into place. But in a recent video you have, you also dig deeper into the tricks used in the Gregorian calendar to hide and obscure the timeline. What have you learned about these tricks from this side?
Yes, I posted some updated information on the calendar tricks. It was actually an improved version of the previous video. What happened is, after I published The Survivors, so many people sent me additional material. Like, for example, this man from Holland. He found this translation of this decree from Holland, how they were threatening the people not to use the old calendar and with severe punishments. Simply, there was an additional evidence, so I can say I believe the new chronology more and more after publishing The Survivors. And another thing not related to the calendar, but what in Italy made me remember the new chronology and respect it even more were paintings in what is officially called Etruscan necropolises. Each and every necropolis has it's a UNESCO site, so it is with paid entry, very famous. It's called Tarquinia. It's a big thing. And each and every necropolis, there are a couple of dozens of them, has a label outside, modern, saying the exact year when the person was buried. And there were a couple of them with murals inside that looked as if taken from a modern cartoon book for children. It was amazing. We had an art historian in our group. She also said, I don't know what to think about this. There were two necropolises with such paintings. All the others looked typical Etruscan. All the others looked the way we are told people used to paint 2,000 years ago. And then in two of them, cartoons. And then to make it even more confused, everything, we found the third one where the lower part of a person was in cartoonish style and the upper part was in the old style. I don't know, is this some sort of extremely poor restoration? Nothing can surprise me in Italy. I mean, like in their most famous necropolis of Bandi Tacha with paid entry and again a UNESCO site. I mean, people were doing toilets in the necropolises. Nobody was cleaning. I was shocked. And this was the first site we visited.
Jeez.
So nothing would surprise me after that in Italy. But in terms of respect to historic sites, so did they paint those cartoons just like that and say it's an old necropolis? Is it some really poor restoration? I don't know. They look old. They don't even look restored. Mm-hmm. But in case these are original paintings, then people should have been painting in that style just a couple of hundred years ago. And then I remembered Fomenko writes that according even to some mainstream historians, the Etruscans continued to exist much longer along with the Romans.
Hmm.
If that is true, and considering the 1,000-year shift back, it means, in reality, that the Etruscans could have continued to exist even up until the Reformation. And then this type of paintings could be justified. But otherwise, styles like that, it was really shocking difference.
Man, that is interesting. And you mentioned the 1,000-year switch. For anyone who missed our previous conversation about it, dates used to be written with an I in front of the year. And it seems like one of the big manipulations they did to extend the timeline was just change that I to the number 1, and then you get an extra 1,000 years. Is that about accurate?
Yes, exactly like that.
Hmm. And I love the documents you do reproduce in this most recent video. I think some of them, like you mentioned, some of them are updated or are new. They have a huge list of banned books from that day. If you were found with those books, they were burned, you were burned, and that's anything that didn't fit with their new chronology. And they had very strict commissions to make sure that these books weren't being, you know, transferred around. They controlled publishing at the time. So there's another way to control what gets made. And border checks, you talk about being very common. And that's what they were looking for, is, you know, information crossing borders that contained some of the information that they wanted changed. And like you mentioned, sending decrees out saying, you know, don't look at these books anymore, change the calendar. They also change the names of towns. And that's a pretty important thing, because when you change the name of a town, you also take away its history, its legacy.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Even if somebody finds a correct record of what happened, then they wouldn't know where it is because the town is gone.
Yeah.
And they changed the way peoples are named. Now we are into these family names. Before, in the name of the person would be specified to which clan he belongs, and he would keep his clan history. But now our names are again putting us in a smaller box only of our immediate family. And the memory of the clan, this is one way to erase the memory of the clan, by not even letting people know to which clan they belong.
That is a great point, too. And that kind of brings me to a quote that I had heard from you, as you said that the underlying attack of this false chronology is that it is really not just our heritage, our history, but it's an attack on human consciousness itself. Maybe you could elaborate on the implications it has on human consciousness.
Well, that is why they did it. If it wasn't this, then it's not even important. How does it matter what happened a few thousand years ago? It doesn't really matter. It's important to live in the present. But because living in the present is so much changed by the way what we identify with, that's why they do it. Not because the past itself is important, but because this past makes us identify with something else. That is the main thing. And that is the only thing that matters to them.
Right. They give us the story that we rose up from apes rather than descending down from consciousness. This is what the ancient esoteric ideas talk more about.
And this is the main point that they want to hide. And why to hide that? So that it prevents us from using our magical powers. Once we start believing that we don't have even magical powers and magical powers don't even exist, then with that belief, we disable them, because the rule is that our thoughts and consciousness and intentions, they affect the matter around. And once we believe that we don't have magical powers and magic is nonsense, it becomes so.
Mm-hmm. I'm with you. And last time, one of the things we talked about even today, this idea of a relatively peaceful world of coexistence before the parasites took over, a big part of this was creating borders and pitting cultures against each other. That idea really stuck with me. But come to find out, the Vedas actually describe the creation of divided states and countries in their text, right?
Yes.
I thought that was interesting because for all I knew, it was a speculation of sorts. I didn't know there was actual documented evidence that actually talked about that carving up of the planet.
Yes, in the beginning, it was Satya Yuga. At that time, it was the time when people could memorize a book just by hearing it. Then there was no need of much technology or even social infrastructure or even trade, because people weren't into these things at all. They would spend most of their time in meditation and interacting with nature in the most direct sense with their thoughts. To put it simplified, these were people who could literally talk with the trees, talk with the river, not in some imaginary way, but most literally. After that, in the next Dwapara Yuga, private property started appearing, some sort of trade. Of course, when you have mine and yours, then exchange and things like that. But still, people were living peacefully and they were highly conscious of their magical powers. They still lived in harmony with nature. And only in Treta Yuga, this division started really with things like jealousy started appearing amongst people, negative emotions, sometimes towards the end, even quarrels. There was a king in Treta Yuga, according to the Vedas, who ruled all over the earth. And it is only in the last Kali Yuga, when we really got divided into countries so that we can fight between each other.
Yeah, that's such a sad situation. And as far as trying to reconstruct what happened, another book you talk about in one of your videos that was new to me is this Book of Balas, a book that seems to have survived and seems to have a 7,000-year history. Can you tell us a little bit about what that outlines that might be so different?
The Book of Veles.
Valis, okay.
Yes, it is somewhat controversial, but most probably it is a genuine book. It is taught, courses on it are taught in several universities of Europe, although they teach it as a legend, not as a real history. But yes, this is one of the books that might have survived the Reformation cleanup of a real history. And it's in full consistency with the Vedic literature and the little bits and pieces of the history that we get from people like Edgar Cayce and others who may have some validity. So it is in consistency with them. This book, it concentrates on the saga of these people who survived from the old advanced civilization and landed somewhere in the area of the Balkans maybe 20,000 years ago. And from there started spreading, teaching the local, very simple tribal people in mostly Asia. Somehow from the Balkans, they headed to Asia, and they, in their own language, sometimes called themselves Aces. That's why Asia is called Asia, mm-hmm. named after them. That was their place.
Wow.
And it describes various wars and difficulties that they faced. And one of these wars was 7,000 years ago. And apparently it was very important for them, because when it ended with a peace treaty, they decided to make this date, the beginning date of a new calendar. And that calendar was used in Russia. And apparently also other places in Europe, as I found out later on by a person who did the research in Croatia and contacted me. He also found on the statue monuments references to a calendar that starts some 7,000 years ago. So apparently this calendar was used. Such a calendar was used in this area. That is yet another, the statue connection is yet another confirmation of the possible validity of the Book of Veles. And of course, the use of this calendar in Russia, that is not disputed, is another confirmation. So this saga tells details of how these Aces were mixing with the simple tribes and spreading their culture. They were from the survivors of the older civilization. I don't know if it is exactly Atlantis, because Atlantis also, it's a double thing. It had good and bad Atlanteans. So apparently they were those who survived from the good ones. And they were mostly presiding the earth. They were basically ruling the earth during these thousands of years. As much as I can gather from such sources, probably these are exactly these survivors that I'm talking about.
Right. I mean, that is amazing. Just the idea of an artifact that survived the Reformation period and the stomping out of all that stuff, the burning of everything, because those are invaluable resources. And my eyes were just really opened by the new chronology paradigm, thanks to you. And, you know, I still get messages of people that are skeptical of it, but I think one of the best things you could point people towards is that Isaac Newton, he was very well aware of this and he wrote about it. He said that Egypt was set back 1800 years, Greece was set back 500 years, Rome was set back about 1,000 years, and he wrote a book that you can find free online called The Chronology of Ancient Kingdoms. You can easily find the PDF. I've looked at it. It's a little tough to read. It's a little over my head, but it's definitely there. And he makes his case. And people want to value him in the realms of science, but not value him in the realms of chronology.
Yes, he was a chronologist, but they're conveniently skipping this part, this facet of him. They're always presenting him as a physicist, because that much is convenient to them. So this new chronology is not a new idea. It's just an old idea that is getting revived. And it has many intelligent and well-educated people amongst its admirers.
I'm with you. And you know, a lot of this, we talked about this last time, but Robert Newton is the guy who took the old historic data about the moon, realized there was a lot of erratic behavior from the moon that didn't fit the established pattern of eclipses and phases. And then Fomenko tried to mathematically correct it. And that's kind of what got us started last time and what we've been talking about today with the restoration of the real chronology. And the reason for that is because it's much more reasonable to suggest that documents, human documents, were changed rather than the actual pattern of a celestial body like the moon. But I have had guests that say, no, something did actually happen with the moon not that long ago. And they're citing people like Velikovsky, which I know you're familiar with Velikovsky. But how do we really rectify that? I mean, it does seem way more likely that human documents would be changed, but there are those researchers who make the case that it was actually the moon that changed, maybe from the influence of the newly formed Venus or something similar. But do you have any thoughts on Velikovsky's work and the idea that there was an actual change in the solar system on that scale?
I see the theories of Velikovsky as an attempt to create somewhat milder version of the mainstream historic fantasies. Maybe the timeline he suggested was somewhat more truthful than the mainstream one. Maybe not. It is just too close for it, and he often bases his conclusions on mainstream historic data, which in essence means basing them on fantasy. And as people say, the fruit doesn't fall far from the tree. I personally even lack the patience to study his work to start with. When I heard few things that he apparently takes for given as absolute proven truth, and the worst of them is to take for granted that all the myths and legends and oral history are an attempt of the simple people to explain events that are far above their heads that they don't understand with simple words. Because supposedly all the advanced ones died in global catastrophes many thousands of years ago. No, they did not die, all of them. And the proofs are, for example, the medieval maps made with digital accuracy and the polygonal megaliths, for example, of St. Petersburg. Many of them built definitely within the past few hundred years. In terms of looks and quality of masonry polygonal work and the size of the blocks, they are absolutely as those mystical so-called alien megaliths of Peru. Another excellent example are the polygonal, again, huge megaliths of the Khmer dynasties in nowadays Cambodia. Although most of the blocks there are regularly shaped with right angles, at places clearly polygonal masonry can be seen with very smooth sides of the stones inside, perfect fitting. I personally think they were cast, but in terms again of quality of masonry work, identical as those of Peru. These Khmer megalithic structures are so recent that even at places parts of the original wooden doors have survived. And that's in a jungle-like environment with high humidity where everything rots super fast. So to claim that all the people who knew the secrets of advanced building of so-called mystery alien megaliths died long ago, some 12,000 years ago or something like that, in a great catastrophe. To say that, one actually needs to wear blinders not to see that there are identical or very similar megaliths belonging to numerous relatively recent cultures. And when I say recent, I really mean very recent. I think the Khmer megaliths are more recent even than their mainstream dating, because one can read articles in the scientific publications and the newspapers saying that Angkor Wat is being destroyed by the trees that grow in between the stones with alarming rate only recently. So what, those trees were not growing before? Actually, it is a shameless lie that these megaliths were discovered by the Europeans. No, the region was absolutely densely populated, and when the European colonial forces came, they simply slaughtered or twisted the minds of the local population, destroyed their society, poisoned their minds, and that's when they stopped taking care of their megaliths, and that's when the trees started growing. I really studied, paid very close attention to how much old trees are there, how big are they, and this is exactly consistent with this time. If the site was abandoned a couple of hundred years ago, it would be exactly in this state as it is now. I agree that my thoughts and interpretations about these megalithic sites of St. Petersburg, the Khmer megaliths and Japan may not be absolutely correct. And I'm tolerant of other opinions, because often I end up finding them better than my own and adopting them eventually. But I really have a problem with people who simply ignore them. People who take few selected examples of very fine polygonal stone masonry and build their conclusions only on them and excluding everything else from their works because it doesn't fit their ideas. I think this approach of selectively picking up sites and excluding others is not healthy for real scientific work.
Mm-hmm. That's well said. And examining the foliage like that is pretty brilliant. It seems like a great way to get at the truth around these places. And to talk more about that, so often the remains of these dead cultures or civilizations are buried or obscured or eroded, like we talked about earlier. And in some of your videos, these structures are in such bad shape, they can often be mistaken for natural formations, just like Italians storing their garden tools in cutout areas they mistake for something natural. These remnants can be very easy to miss in most cases, and as widespread as they do seem to be, can you give the listeners any advice or tips for how to tell the difference between an odd natural formation and something worn down that might have been man-made, so that they could potentially start seeing things that are maybe right in their own backyard?
Yes, I can definitely tell them how to do it for sure. Start going regularly on expeditions. It worked for me. Yes, Spain and Italy, it opened my eyes a lot about these things. I have an old video about the Meltaliths, and the questions that I asked there, some of them got answered during my expeditions. I have so much new material that I don't have a time to make a new version of it. But I definitely have a lot of new stuff about that. The only tip is going and looking at many historic sites. Otherwise, it's just from one photo, it usually turns into an interpretation
You definitely have gotten me thinking differently, because I've driven across the United States several times to go back to my hometown in Missouri, and you drive through New Mexico and Arizona and these desert states, and there is a lot of open, empty space that's out there, and it just makes you think when you're driving for hours and hours through this large swath of unpopulated land, you think about what it might have been in the ancient past, and you think, if the roads don't go there, then no one's going to go there. There could be a Göbekli Tepe in the middle of the state of New Mexico, and no one would see it or know it's there because there isn't a road that drives to it. Because if there isn't a road, I mean, we just aren't going there. So yeah, get out off the beaten path and maybe look in areas that people aren't looking.
Yes, and something very interesting. If you put into the search engine Bomarzo Pyramid, you will see the historic site, which was recently discovered. And how was it discovered? It was always there. It's not covered with earth and anything. And it is practically on a tourist, not a tourist path. It is on a forest walk path, very near it. Just a question of going 10 or 20 meters aside. Maybe it's very nearby villages. It's not even in a remote area. Just nobody ever bothered to go there. Although the full forest is full of ruins. The full forest, it's very difficult to stand at one place and not to see a ruin. And we walked there kilometers and kilometers. It was just ruins nonstop. And still, nobody bothered to go to that. It's not so much of a pyramid, but it resembles, and now it's discovery since a couple of years, just to confirm your words that amazing things can be out there and we just don't know about them.
Mm-hmm. It's exciting, to tell you the truth. And as we're getting ready to wrap this up, I do love the crowdsourcing approach that you take at megaliths.org. And you've helped me out so much by coming on the show, helping with the Alexander Koltypin episode. I'd love to see the audience get involved in this project and help you document things that they might be near. So maybe tell the listeners, how can people contribute to extending this catalog of ancient sites that you're working on at megaliths.org?
Yes, definitely. Just submit new sites. It's very easy. It's a very easy submission form, very small. And yeah, this is much appreciated because it takes long time. I have many sites on file. I just can't submit them because I have garden. Also, I have to do videos and things like that. I'm submitting maybe half of them. The rest is user submitted. I was expecting that people will be much more active. Unfortunately, they are not as active as I expect.
Mm.
Now I'm planning to make some videos available only for those who submit sites. Let's see if it will work.
That's what you got to do. That's what you got to do. But I love it. And I will say also, I'll back you up and say that the megaliths.org site is the best catalog I've seen of ancient sites. I mean, you have so many different things I've never heard of, and we can talk about it all day, but you got to see the pictures for them to really resonate. And you also have a section on the website that lists sites that you're looking for more photographic evidence of. You have them, you know they exist, but you don't have the real person on the ground taking the photos and submitting them. And that would be a good place to start for people. If you just look at the list of sites that you're still looking for photos of, and they might find on the map that they're near three or four of them, even I did, that would be the place to start. And that's how someone could contribute to what I think is pretty amazing work.
Yes, thank you. That I should have mentioned that. Thanks for it.
No worries. And I also want to ask, are there places, where's the next expedition outside of Italy? Now that you've been there, is there another place you have in mind for the future?
Yes, in December, I plan to go to Malta. And in spring, I want to go to Italy again and Spain again. And maybe Turkey if it is peaceful. And I don't know if I can do all that.
Malta is definitely fascinating. Land of giants, they said.
And most importantly, I hope this winter to go to the Philippines and meet in person those famous surgeons that make surgery with their hands. You know, they penetrate into your body and take out things from inside, just with their psychic powers. So that will be the next adventure after Malta.
Very exciting. Wow. Well, Sylvie, I always learn so much from talking with you and keeping up with your videos. There's so much we didn't get to talk about, but there's only so many hours in the day. So thanks again. Do you have any last words for the people before we go?
Yes, the main reason for which I make my videos is to inspire people to develop their magical powers.
Hmm. Fair enough. So hopefully people will get working on that. Awesome. Well, check out Sylvie's New Earth YouTube channel and the amazing resource that is megaliths.org. And hopefully we can talk again down the line. Take care of yourself out there.
Thank you very much and have a nice evening.
There we go. Isn't she great? Sometimes it's a bit hard to catch the names of some of these places in a way that you can find them online, but we're going to try to do you justice in the show notes, I promise. I just love this idea that our current system of control is really only a few generations old, and I think she can make a pretty good case for it. I really think the fact that Isaac Newton wrote a book on this very thing is something that should give anyone pause before they dismiss it outright. It's a wild thought exercise also, I know. It's hard to reconcile the story in your head, to rethink about how much weathering and erosion really do affect these megaliths. And I haven't thought about this in a long time, but let me tell you a little something about erosion. Growing up, I used to love going out to my cousin's house in Chicago, Joliet to be specific. But behind his house was a decent-sized yard, and then a two-lane road, a median, a couple extra feet, a concrete divider, and then a massive cliff with a river down like 15, 20 stories. A fun place for kids to throw rocks and fireworks and stuff. And over the course of just the 20 or so years I'd been going there, first the erosion works right up to that road, then it took half of that and became a one-lane road, then it took the other half and just left the little median, then it took that, and last I saw, it had worked right up to the backyard, and they had to build a big fence there. And I know there's like many different types of erosion, and it's not all the same thing, but that's just one example of things moving pretty quickly. Like, that house probably won't be there in 50 years. And have you ever seen that show Life After People? Granted, our construction now is nothing like it was, but they talk about how after just a few decades, everything would be wilded over. We saw what the Rockefellers did in a much more modern age with Prohibition. Got everyone to forget alcohol was a viable fuel in just 10 years. What could you make indigenous people forget about their traditions and ways of life and sacred sites when you impress them with your ships and guns and armor? And of course, one of the first things they create is a school to reteach you things, to whitewash your history, so to speak. I can imagine it being so easy to get caught up in. And then the jungle reclaims those sacred sites, and when they're rediscovered, the experts say, oh, those are thousands of years old, and that's just some primitive stuff, you don't need to worry about that. Because that's the narrative they were taught to regurgitate to get their degrees. They don't really know. It's interesting. I think there are more learned people than I who are probably pulling their hair out listening to me ramble like this as if it's in any way scientific. But isn't it worth a look? Time is just so crazy because even the official history says the Holy Roman Empire ended in, what year would you think? Would you guess 1806? I mean, that sounds so recent to me. It's a lot to ponder to say these megaliths are only a couple hundred years old in some cases. Does seem pretty radical, but it was only 180 years ago we were getting typhoid fever on the Oregon Trail. Now we have self-driving Teslas and smartphones, just 180 years later. But even just then, just saying it didn't sound right. I had to go look it up. But if you do, it says from 1811 to 1840 is when the Oregon Trail was laid down by traders and fur trappers, and when it comes to the wagon trains, that started in 1836, 180 years ago. And if America was founded right around the same time as the Big Manipulation, and Europe's history was altered at that point, I see why Sylvier says anything before that is suspect. Think of the conquistadors and Napoleon as missions to wipe everyone out and rewrite history, taking basically full control of the Western world. I mean, I'm painting with a pretty broad brush, and there's supposed to be about 400 years between those things, but I just think there's something to this. I'm running with it. I'm not a flat earther, but when someone says that that idea is too big for them to have drilled into everyone's heads, I'm not so sure it would be, because I'm not a monotheist either. So I see that as something old authorities crafted, attacked the competition, and it spread pretty damn far. That's like a fact. So what else could they have made up or manipulated? In areas of science, in areas of history, in medicine? Vatican monks wrote most of our chronology, and Vatican astronomers gave us the Big Bang Theory. Are these people to be trusted? I also find it interesting when Sylvier brings up the Incas, the fact that we don't really know anything about them. She noted that the records from the conquistadors are sealed. I think that's pretty interesting. There's probably so much in those documents. I would love to know. Because another great point is that we have these elongated skulls, and they do look like they're in pretty good shape, the ones I've seen. I mean, I'm no expert. I couldn't try to date them accurately, but these stories of giants and other beings, how old are they really? How do they fit into the story? I don't know. Maybe it's just the nature of things for big ideas to be traced back to only a few people. But in so many areas, I think that leaves room for manipulation, and it makes me really skeptical. Some might even say paranoid, but so be it. And of course, I always talk to my guests longer for members who support the show, and today is no different. In the second hour, we talked about a lot of great stuff, a little about phantom lands and cultures that have been scrubbed from mainstream history but can still be found on some old maps, other researchers that she has synthesized that don't reach American audiences that often, the Gregorian calendar manipulation, her near-death experience and ayahuasca journeys, and a really great summary of the predictions of several seers and prophets that don't get told in English all that often. All good stuff. So sign up for $5 a month. You get the full archive, free downloads of THC music. You can unlock the Plus portion of the iPhone app that THC has, the videos from my Armenia trip with Graham Hancock that I'm still working on, and the forum, of course. And guys, I know I've neglected the forum a little bit, specifically the introduction thread, but for some reason, my login, because it's the administrator's, is not jiving all that well with the forum login. But I'm going to be purchasing a new forum really soon, a better infrastructure, a pretty robust and professional forum. It's going to cost me a couple hundred bucks a year, but we're bringing quality to the world of conspiracy, something that it has historically lacked. And speaking of quality, check out the HigherSideClothing.com for great designs based off your favorite THC episodes. We got owls fighting spiders, JP Morgan blowing up the Titanic, Baphomet, Archons, quality all day. I'm telling you. I have a hard time playing the salesman without kind of mocking it, but it is what makes my world go round, and I appreciate all the support. Big thanks to Sylvier. The extra clips were also very much appreciated. I think so. I'm sure you'd agree. Check out her megaliths.org to see a super robust catalog of sites and click on the map to find areas near you that she would love some better reference photos for. She's been good to us, so let's try to repay that favor and actually contribute to something important. That's it for me, folks. Your move, hackers of history, killers of cultures, and manipulators of minds. Your fucking move.
Oh no. You see, the world isn't random, it's attached to puppet strings. Control over everything. The 9 to 5 is trying to steal ya. Now don't that job seem silly? Hello, can you hear me? Or should I play back recordings from some spy agency? Wish we were younger and free. I'll be thankful when it's all exposed, the vast conspiracy. There's such a difference between us and the damned rock.
Hello from the but we